Thank you. Let's give another round of applause for Miss Law and the Wako Japanese American Dance Group. We're going to keep things rolling right now. We're getting ready to bring up some wonderful hunting guides from over at Beanville Plantation. That's a hunting club just right here in Hamilton County, just north of us a little ways, just north of White Springs. We're going to bring up a couple of folks here and just take us just a second to get things started back up.
Hello?
Cocoa Thrasher.
Cocoa Thrasher.
What is it? Coconut?
Let's go ahead and just try to keep things going here. We're going to go ahead and talk with Cocoa Thrasher, who's a duck guide, an expert duck caller, and Mike Hatfield?
Hadaway.
I'm sorry. I've lost my mind. Mike Hadaway. They're both from up at Beanville Plantation. Mike is a quail expert and can tell us a little bit about quail hunting, or probably a whole lot if we want to listen. And we'll just try to keep things moving here. Did you guys want to sit down? Or you stand?
We'll stand up.
Okay. Why don't we start with you, Coco? And first of all, tell us a little bit about how you got started calling. And then give us a good call for something, just a type.
Well, I've been duck hunting for about 30 years now, and how I learned how to duck call was being left on the bank because my duck calling was so bad. So I picked it up by going out and listening to ducks actually on the water, mm-hmm. and got some audio tapes and listened and practice, and you know, the more you do anything, the better you get at it.
Did anybody in your family call ducks community? You just taught yourself?
I guess I'm a first generation duck hunter. I've got two boys that's 12 and 17, and they're avid duck hunters, and they're learning the same way I did. And by mistakes. I would like to say that at Beanville Plantation, we've got some of the best duck hunting in the southeastern United States because we have such a wide variety of species that gather down here. We've got every species of ducks around except for a few that are mainly western coastal birds. And occasionally we'll get some of those, but we get a mixed bag of a lot of divers and puddle ducks. Now, diver ducks are your underwater, your deep diving ducks that eat crayfish and snails and minnows and things of that sort, such as mergansers, redheads, canvasback, ringnecks, sculp, buffleheads, things of this nature. Now, puddle ducks are, we also have plenty of, is mallards, pintail, widgeon, teal, a lot of teal, and wood ducks, a mm-hmm. Great number of wood ducks.
And each different type of duck has its own unique call, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Could you tell? Maybe give us a sample of a couple of different calls and what they're associated with?
Okay, a mallard is probably the most vocal of all the ducks, and to be honest with you, the hen is the one that does all the quacking. A lot of the other ducks, man, they just do whistling, and so I can give you a demonstration of what a mallard hen would sound like. That's what we'd be doing if we were trying to call a duck in. Now, the drake is a whole lot less vocal, and he doesn't quack at all. He'll sound something like this. And that's the way he calls his hens to him when they're sitting on the water and moving around. You can actually call them into your decoys and using this mallard drake call.
About how long, hopefully, does it take to call in a duck?
Hopefully not long. It's ducks get a lot of pressure before they get down here to us. And if you're not good at calling, you can do more harm than good. And if you overcall, you can send them the other direction. Now, a lot of the other ducks do mostly whistling. Like a teal, the first duck you'll see flying in the morning and the one that'll scare you the most, it just makes a little chirp early in the morning. And if you don't be real quiet, you won't even hear him at all, and he sounds something like this. But you get about 15 or 20 of them together chirping like that, and it sounds a lot different. Now, the pintail is a large duck, large puddle duck, and he sounds something like this. And he'll make that sound while he's flying and while he's sitting on the water. Now, the widgeon, the pintail and widgeon are high flyers, and these sounds, they'll look like 1,000 feet in the air, but you can still hear them. These faint whistles, you can still hear them. The widgeon sounds like this. And them ducks flying 50, 60 miles an hour in the wind, 100 feet high, and you can still hear them very, very easily. Wow. So their voice carries a long way.
So if you're going out hunting, how many calls do you take with you? Is this pretty much your rig that you take with you?
This pretty much covers it all, and when it gets exciting, you'll grab one that you don't mean to grab, or you'll stick the wrong end in your mouth, but pretty soon, after a while, you got a feel for what you need. They all got a different shape to them, and and you've got your favorite, some that sounds better. None of the ducks sound the same. They're like people. All voices are different. Well, ducks' voices are different also. You might find a duck with a more shrill quack or more raspy, and some are so more coarse and low-pitched, but they're all different.
Right. Well, let's go ahead and go over to Mike here. It looks like you've got a turkey call in your another duck call.
Ah! Oh, it was a duck call. It's a feeding chatter, and you can also do this with a duck call. One's handheld and
So are all these commercial calls that you just go to the hardware sporting goods store and buy, or?
Both of these are handmade. These are custom calls, but you can buy them in Walmart, just about anywhere. There's different types you can get from different areas, but things like this, you don't see these around anymore. Duck call collecting can get to be a mighty expensive hobby, and they really do cost a lot of money when you start getting the handmade custom calls.
Right. Let's skip on over to get Mike in on this mix here a little bit. Why don't you tell us a little bit about quail hunting and do us a quail call here.
Well, quail hunting in Bentonville. We'll pick you up in a customized Jeep. We'll take you out, and you'll be... We'll go out. We have 8,000 acres that we quail hunt on, and we'll get you off the Jeep. You'll be walking behind a brace of professionally trained dogs.
Need you set down.
My voice and everything to hell. But quail hunting is just, it gets in your blood. It's more, the hunt's great, but like myself, a lot of people, I've taken people out and never fire a gun. They just like to watch the dogs work. It's amazing to watch that creature do his job. I mean, he's out there working just as hard as we.
Describe that to us when you're saying working. A lot of us won't.
That's a locating call. I mean, quail like to stick together. They don't like to be by themselves. I mean, it may just be one or maybe 15. But especially after you've been hunting and the birds get scattered out, you start hitting a locating call. And, I mean, a lot of times the woods will just light up. I've had them whistle as close as from me to Coco. I mean, it'd be hot and the dog, scent conditions would be real bad. Dogs couldn't smell them and whistle, and you have them growl right beside you. I mean, it's amazing.
That's amazing. Let's talk a little bit about the plantation. And how do you guys protect your quail population and duck population? Is it totally up to stocking, or do you do something with keeping of the grounds and that type of thing?
On the quail hunting, we plant. I mean, we've got a lot of native wild birds, but we don't have enough to warrant day in, day out hunting. What we have is a pre-release. Well, we have an early release, a pre-release, and a daily release. As the season gets on into December, January, February, we're putting birds out daily. But we plant food plots. Like right now, if we'd ever get some rain, we start planting food plots. That way, for the birds that are not harvested, they've always got food out there. Mm-hmm. And there's mud holes. I mean, we've got 6,000 acres of water. I mean, we've got channels of water in them. So 35% of most of our birds are pen-raised. And people say, oh, we're shooting tame quail. But anybody can raise a quail. I mean, but to raise a quail that can perform, you can't do that. I mean, you got to have three of our stipulations in our contract. They've got to be fully feathered, flight conditioned, and healthy birds.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, having a bird, I mean, you may have the prettiest bird in the world, but he can get up and fly from here to that bench. I mean, you'll get a dog shot or you'll get a person shot. Right. These birds we get, one of the terms I use, they get up hunting some get feather. I mean, when they get up, they're gone. They try to get out of there. And the people, we've got three main suppliers that are here locally. I mean, Jasper, and I've been in the business 10 years, and they raise some of the best birds I've ever shot or seen shot in my life.
I didn't ask you, how did you get started in quail hunting?
Well, I started quail hunting at an early age with my father. And after high school, after my father died, I mean, I still quail hunted. But a friend of mine was a guide on a plantation in South Georgia. His buggy driver was out one day. He called me, asked, it was on a weekend, told me to come down. And on that particular plantation, if you want to become a guide, you start out as a buggy driver. And I drove a pair of mules, matched mules, gray mules. And he guided off horseback. And that got me in the commercial end of it. And, I mean, once you do it, it gets in your blood. It's unique. I mean, okay. It's especially if you've trained the dog and you know what that dog – the joy you get out of watching that dog perform – and to hear the compliments you get on it, it's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Coco, how about you as far as the duck population? How do you guys?
We hunt strictly wild ducks. Now, these are migratory ducks. We don't have any release birds, and we've got to go strictly by the migration of the duck. The blue and green winged teal, they migrate earliest of all the ducks on this Atlantic flyway out of Canada. And they start migrating in early September. Mm-hmm. And so before the season even opens in November, we've already got a good population of ducks wintering here at Beanville Plantation.
Do you do anything to court that wintering, or is it just something that's naturally happening anyway?
We've got so many thousands of acres of water, and this is a wintering
haven.
Haven for them. I mean, we've got everything they need. We've
so
got
much vegetation.
We've got so mm-hmm. much vegetation. We've got light cover. We've got open water. We've got everything a duck likes.
Mm-hmm. Most of the time when we think about hunting in this part of Florida, most people are talking about dog hunting for deer and turkey hunting is real popular. Duck hunting and quail hunting are really a different type of hunting tradition in this area. How long has duck hunting really been around? Is it a long-standing tradition in this area, or is it kind of a growing in popularity?
Duck hunting over the years, back when ladies used to wear the big hats, you know, with all the nice flowers and everything, they used to shoot ducks off the bows with cannons, and they'd kill thousands of ducks with just one shot. And they would sell the meat, and then they'd pluck the feathers. And the down's feathers were used for coats and pillows and everything like that. And the decorative feathers were sold to hat makers for the hats and things. So, you know, ducks were almost extinct at one time in the early 40s, mid-40s. They were almost a thing of the past. And the federal laws put regulations on them, and ducks made a big comeback. Mm-hmm. And it's... To be a duck hunter, you got to be nuts to start with. Who wouldn't want to get up 3 o'clock in the morning go out in the freezing cold, freezing rain, and sit in a boat and shoot a few ducks. But there's a whole lot more to it that it's a camaraderie with your friends. It's the sunrise, seeing the sunrise over a set of decoys. I mean, it makes it all. I've told myself I'm never doing this again. And I'll get out there and I'll see my kids out there. They're setting their decoys. I mean, they're kids and they're into it and they're loving it. It's good for kids. They learn about the outdoors. They learn about wildlife conservation, and there's so much for them to learn.
The thing that impresses me so much is that there's so much more to hunting than the kill. You know, there's this real romance with nature between man. I mean, the imitating with calls and trying to lure the animal in. So I think that's wonderful. Speaking of luring animals in, could you tell us a little bit about the decoys and how you place decoys and the type of decoys you use?
Decoys, ducks always try to land into the wind, just like an airplane would on an aircraft carrier or any other way. Ducks are the same way. They like to, they cup the wind, they glide in, and that's where you set your decoys in a horseshoe. There's several different kinds of figurations you can use for decoy spreads. You can use a hook, or you can use a mast, or you can use a horseshoe. It just depends on what's comfortable with you, what works for you. One other thing I can tell you, too, about ducks, when ducks mate, they mate for life. They'll stay together till one of them perishes, and then they'll find them a new mate then. But decoys are an intricate part of duck hunting. There's all kinds of wood carving, different types of decoys, different makes, working decoys. There's electric decoys. We've got technical. They got them to where they bob up and down in the water. They'll do anything now. But if you've ever tried to buy some handmade antique decoys, you'll know that they're really expensive. And it's an art. It's an art to carve one of these. Mike Allen over here at the tent next to us, he carves decoys. Mm-hmm. He's always placed in first, second, or third in the Florida State competition with decoys and take them to the art classes at school. And we would take pictures of the ducks, and the kids would repaint the ducks after they got just worn. And it was a great project for the kids.
Sounds wonderful.
They learned a lot about ducks this way. But there's all different types and styles. You can buy half decoys that's sticking up like that. You can buy them. It's got a little vibrating motor inside that makes them wiggle and makes them look like they're actually alive on the water.
Mm-hmm.
It just goes on. You can put as much money into it as you want to.
Did we have any questions from the audience at all? If anybody had, right here. Let me repeat the question. That way we'll make sure we get it on the tape. A gentleman asked about training dogs and wanted to know what age we should start training.
I start when I wean them. When I take him away from his mother, that's when I start on bird dogs. And we're labs, too. Like I was telling earlier on the narrative stage, every lab I've ever trained, I've had 8 or 9 personal labs. Some of them I've gotten at 5 weeks, but legally by law you can't get them till they're 8 weeks old. A lab's brain develops from the time he's 8 weeks old to he's 16 weeks old. That dog will learn everything you want to teach him in that length of time. Everyone I've ever gotten, they stayed by my side 24/7. Slept with me. When I was working, they stayed in my truck with me for the first 16 weeks of their life. And by the time you're 16 weeks old, there's nothing in this world you ask that dog to do that he won't do. You'd be surprised how smart a dog is. I told a buddy of mine his lab was smarter than him. I mean, I've trained my labs not. You take a piece of steak, hand it to him, he wouldn't take it from me until I told him to, and then I could tell him it was bad, and he'd spit it out. I mean, the more time you spend with an animal, I don't care if it's a cat or a bird, anything, the more time you spend with it, the easier it is to train them. They're what I call personalizing. A lot of trainers don't do that, but I love personalizing with an animal. That's why when I train one, it kills me to get rid of him. That's why I've got 14 dogs right now.
We had another question out here. Someone had their hand up. or this gentleman over here, I think, had a question before. Okay. Could you maybe just tell what type of call it is and then maybe demonstrate
These are two of my mallard calls. I call them mallard calls. Most ducks will respond to them. Then I have a mallard drake call. And out of this call, you can get your pintail, your teal, and your mallard drake out of it. If I was in a duck hunting situation and I had ducks coming by me or close to me, I saw them, I might do something like this. Started turning and coming back to me, then I'd soften up the call a little bit and just try to make him feel comfortable. And he might throw in a little bit of feeding chatter like what duck sounds when they're feeding. As you get closer, you're softening your calls. And then they'll come right on in. But if you get ducks coming to you, if you don't want to just wail on them, too much calling can send them the other way.
How about the other calls? The other calls that you have?
I use these on pintails as well as teal. And that's pintail and the teal early in the morning. And two or three guys around your duck blind, if a lot of people get together and they start calling, you know, it sounds like a group of ducks. And they look and they listen. But like I said, the time the ducks get down here to us, they've been hunted real hard. And so our calling is limited because they have become so wary. So
if they've made it this far south, they've honed their knowledge of hunting.
They've learned about hunting.
Lori had a question out here.
Yeah. There are books on duck calls. I mean, they're everywhere. You can find out from the library. People today still make handmade duck calls, and they're some of the finest. But they're very expensive, and they're almost to the point where you don't want to take them home. You don't want to, but they're a work of art, just like the decoys are. I don't know that there's a local duck call carver in this area, in North Florida or Southeast. I know there's several out along the Mississippi Flyway where the duck hunting is more popular than it is here. It's more traditional. And in Louisiana, there's a lot of because I've contacted these people and I've gotten duck calls from them. I've probably got 50 duck calls at the house that I would never take them out and use them, but they're all. My wife said, "Don't bring nothing else home, ducky."
Turkey call making, I think, is more common in this area.
Yeah,
you see, find a lot of guys who make their own turkey calls. Go ahead.
That was made by a dear friend of mine. Night and Hail makes a quail whistle, but it's real light and hollow. But a friend of mine's a world 1998 world quail calling champion, and this is handmade. And there's not that many of them. I mean, he'll make them and sell them, but they're high. But Macon, Georgia. Robbie Purser, he's a national sporting clay shooting champion, and we grew up hunting together. And he always had a knack for whistling birds. I said, "Robbie, you ought to make a whistle." So he took a piece of 1-inch stainless tubing, two pieces of brass shim, and it works. I mean,
do it again.
It's, you make all different kind of tones with it. And you think there's a lot of pressure at that, but the harder you're drawing in and dropping your tongue from the roof of your mouth. So the lighter, the better. I mean, I'm barely sucking in on this thing. You hit a real slow, or then in the, you can pick up the pace. What gets them, you'll hit two different tones, and that change in tone That bird, they'll lay. I've sat there and watched them this time of year when they're pairing off and they're mating. I drive them nuts. I just sit there and see some out in the field start whistling, and you'll see those rooster birds just throw their old head back and start singing to the high heavens. I mean, they'll run to you. I had one the other day. He was 200 yards away from me, and I started whistling, and his head perked up, and he ran in a dead run right to me, right there, and was just looking at me. It was amazing.
We'll be wrapping things up, but I wanted to ask you, Beanville's really, like I've said before, the elite of the hunt clubs. If somebody's wanting to get into hunting duck or quail, what are we looking at? What would they need to actually to become a hobbyist hunter? What do they need?
To become a hobbyist hunter?
Yeah.
Definitely, they need to have a hunter, take the hunter safety course if they've never hunted before in their life. I mean, that's from young to old. I mean, last year I took a couple of kids of a guy. He's one of our regular customers, and his two boys had never hunted. They'd hunted a little bit, never quail hunted. And he said, "Mike, I want you to teach them." And he brought them up there and paid the price. And I took them out, and, I mean, he videotaped the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And he never opened his mouth. And, I mean, that morning it was real slow. I think they killed about six birds apiece. That afternoon, between the two of them, they killed 35 quail. I mean, they had it together. But if somebody wants to get into it, take a hunter safety course, because in anything, safety.
I think by law now, it's a law that you take a hunter safety course before you can purchase a state license. And I think it's a law that you have to have the hunter safety course, whether you're 16 or older, to get an out-of-state license in a lot of mm-hmm. states.
If you were born after the year 1960.
Yeah.
So, but as far as open hunting land, you just have to check with the state.
Yeah.
Because if they don't have any private land they can hunt on.
Okay. Well, anything else you guys want to add to this? Because we're rounding up. We think we're going over time. Do we have the next group coming?
We're 8 miles up the road, 8 miles north on 41.
One of the things that you're talking about getting kids started, one of the things Beanville is doing this year, and this is about getting kids started into it, is Beanville's hosting the state Green Wing event for Radio Forum. It's 8 hours of everything a kid has ever wanted to do with hunting and fishing. Bear Archery comes out with 3D targets. They shoot bows and arrows. Crossman BB Guns does the BB guns, the hunter safety, everything. It's a day of just all a kid wanted to do as far as hunting and fishing at Beanville Plantation. It's going to be on September 11th. I'll be listening in several of the larger local newspapers, and it's a good way to get kids started hunting and fishing.
Great. Well, since we don't have any other groups here left to go on, I wanted to get you guys to do a couple more calls for us, and then we'll just call it quits. Before they do their calls, let's give another round of applause to Mike and Coco. And thank Beanville Plantation for bringing them here.
Well, I don't
hate it, Maestro.
All right, now let's see. I had my other duck hunting buddy here earlier, but he had to go back to work, and we were given a situation that what it would be like if it was really in a boat hunting. And so we see the birds and we start calling. Then I tell Leroy, "Shut up, Leroy, they're coming in, they're coming in." And then Leroy gets that, "Knock it off." And so he settles down a little bit, and then he starts giving a little feeding chatter. And so he keeps on, and we get the ducks in. We get the ducks in. A lot of times we don't always use a shotgun. A lot of times we use a camera. And that way we know our shots are good. But and that's basically it. And
a different type of calling for a different type of day, is that what?
Yeah, different times of the day or different
situations. No, there's a feeding call that is very hard to imitate. I've heard one person imitate it in my life. That's why he's a world champion. And he does it naturally with his mouth. But the call I did, it's a callback call. I mean, when they're by themselves, that's the most common call used. You hit that. Well, let me hit it again. Yeah. Majority of the time, you'll hardly ever hear a female call unless she's by herself. If she's not, the male will be doing all the calling. And it's just, like I said, it's just that. And then sometimes they'll, when they're real close, I mean, they'll do that just walking around feeding. It's hard to imitate, but most of what gets them is, I mean, a lot of times I'll hit that with my mouth, and then that different tone. I mean, you can actually watch them. They'll hear that different tone. They'll pick their heads up. They can't stand it. They got to start talking back to you.
Like I said, we're still waiting for another group, so I'm going to ask another question here again. What we've been talking about duck calling and quail calling. Why don't you tell us about all the other sporting things that go on at Beanville?
At Beanville Plantation, we have a little over 18,000 acres, 6,000 of it being water. We have some of the best bass, bream, and crappie fishing in the world. It's bar none. I mean, it's unbelievable. We fish phosphate pits, and don't hold me to this because I'm not a biologist or anything, but something to do with the growth rate. Like doubles the growth rate, and you'll catch a 2-pound fish that'll feel like you got a 5-pound fish. We've got the fishing, we've got deer hunting, we've got hog hunting, we've also got gator hunting. If you've never experienced gator hunting, I went on my first one 2 weeks ago, and it was an experience. Sneaking up on a big old lizard.
Got one more question here, and we'll have to call it quits here. Go ahead.
Yes, sir, I do. We've got a booth set up over here. I've got some brochures. We're 8 miles north on 41. Go out here to Highway 41, take a left, and the easiest way to do it is go to the caution light, which is about 4 miles or 3 miles, and take a right, and we're 3.5 miles to the entrance down County Road 137. So basically, we're 8 miles from where I'm standing.
Well, let's thank them again for coming here, and I'm sure they're going to be available for you to talk to for a little while longer here. We're going to have some rodeo roping coming up here real soon, so I'm going to pass this on to Steve Stimpley.
Presentation for today is going to feature Scott Woodward. a master rope operator from the rodeo circuit of Florida. He's known for what they call team roping. Is that correct, Scott?
That's correct.
And he had his partner who was demonstrating the team process a little bit earlier. However, the other fellow had to go to a rodeo over in Troy, Alabama tonight, so he's already on the road. But Scott's going to tell you a little bit about this event, which is very popular at the at rodeos, and give you an example of how it's done, and hopefully invite a few of you all to come up and try your hand at it. Scott, why don't you give him a little background?
Team roping originated in the. Is this gone? Testing. Team roping originated on the ranch where they would. Cows that were too big to throw down, where you see calf roping and all, where you see the guys go out and rope the calf, throw them down and tie them up. Steer roping came along afterwards when the steers were sick and all, and they were too big to pick up and throw down. They would do what was called rope their head and rope their feet. And as years went by, it developed into a sport in rodeo called team roping. And what it is now, it's a timed event. Whoever has the fastest time wins all the money. You have two people. The reason it's called team roping, you have two people. You got a header and a heeler. And the way the event works is that you got a cowboy on the left-hand side, and you got a cowboy on the right side, and they're in a pen. They got a cow in a chute, which is a box that he's trapped inside. The header sits on the left-hand side. He nods his head, and that's when the steer is released. The clock starts as soon as the steer is released. The header goes out, ropes him by his head. It's either got to be slick horns, a half head, or neck. Once he does that, he's got to dally the rope off to the saddle horn of a saddle, turn the steel to a 90-degree angle, and then the heeler, which is on the right-hand side, has got to come in behind the steer and catch his back feet. If he only catches one foot, it's a 5-second penalty to your total time. If he catches both feet, there's no penalty and it's clean. Average time is usually around 8 seconds or so. It's one of the more, I guess, team roping is one of the bigger sports here in rodeo that's within the state of Florida. There's a lot of jackpots out there that a lot of people go to also, and there's a lot of sanctioned stuff where there's USTRC team roping. Where they're just nothing more there but just team roping. And they give away anything from trucks to trailers to saddles to buckles, right down to just plain money. And it's a fun sport. And if I want to, if I can get someone to hold a mic, I'll do some demonstration just to kind of give an idea of what it is.
What I can do is I'll hold the mic, and you know, when you have more things you want to add,
okay.
I can give it back
well,
to you.
I mean, ain't that me? Unless they record it, then I guess we can talk into the mic.
Yeah. So, Scott, you were explaining that the way the scoring works on this is not by points, but by time.
The time usually starts when you nod your head and the steer is released out the end of the chute. And then the time is stopped as soon as the header and the heeler faces one another and their ropes are dallied around their steer, around the saddle horn. And then I'm just going to demonstrate how they throw their ropes and all.
Okay, now are you going to demonstrate a particular type of catch, or we'll just see which one ends up?
Yeah, we'll see which one ends up.
Okay. Okay, slick horn is what we're maybe. Now that was legal or illegal?
That's a legal kick. Neck's legal.
Okay. That was a neck, okay.
Usually what happens is whenever the steer backs into the box or the header backs into the box, he gets his rope right and he faces his horse towards the steer. And he nods, and there's a guy sitting up on top of the chute, and he's called a chute man. And whenever you nod, the steer is released. As soon as the steer is released, you can come out and throw your rope and catch the steer. As soon as you catch the steer around slick horns, you dally off to the saddle horn, the little horn that sits on top of the saddle, and he turns the steer. As soon as the steer is turned, that is when the heeler is legal to go in and catch him by the back feet. If the heeler throws his rope any time before that, that's a disqualification also. I don't know if y'all have ever seen the NFR on TV, the National Finals Rodeo on TV. It comes on during in December and so. But as soon as the heeler comes in, he can twirl his rope and catch him by back feet. I can't, that guide wire is going to get me if I don't. Holding this mic and doing this is a little tricky. Yeah. Okay. Usually the heeler comes in and the horses, the header and the heeler's horse is usually probably 85% of your ability to do it off of horse. I mean, you got to have a horse that's well trained at what we call it is cow into a horse. Usually you see, if you ever see it again when you're watching TV, you'll watch the horse's ears. He'll back his ears down real low and stick his nose out, and he's really watching that steer. And we call that cow, and that horse is really cowing that steer. Wherever that steer goes, that horse is right there with it. You see a lot of times on cutting horses, they do that a lot. Where he gets down and he just works that horse back, works that cow, whichever that cow thinks he's going to go, that horse is just ahead of him. He knows exactly where he's going to be at. But anyhow, whenever the horse turns and pulls that cow in the other direction, the heeler comes in. And what he's trying to do is the cow's feet are hopping back and forth, back and forth. And what he's wanting to do is catch his feet when they're completely back or in the air, like this steer's foot. These steer's feet are in the air. And that's how you practice, because that's what you want to be able to see. So you catch both feet so you're smooth, so you don't get a penalty of 5 seconds for being just one hind leg. As soon as you dally, pick your slack up and dally, and the header turns and faces one another, the flagger drops his flag, and that's when time is stopped. As soon as the time is stopped, that's whatever that time is that the clock person has, that's what's recorded down. Average time on team roping is usually around 8 seconds. It has been the fastest time right now is a 4.3 seconds, the NFR. And fastest time I've probably ever been has been about 5.1, 5 flat. About as fast as I've ever been. Okay. The rope is made out of polygrass rope. There are different lays of rope. You got anywhere from a soft to a medium soft to a medium hard, and a hard medium. A hard medium would be like twirling one of these stiff cables probably. It's very stiff. Usually the heart of the rope, anywhere from a medium on up to a medium hard, hard medium, they use them for the feet because they stay open more because they're so stiff. So they use them because they want it to stay open to go in behind their feet. I'm doing that. What I'm doing? Moving? Oh, okay. Okay. But anyhow, the soft of the rope, usually that's what the header uses, which is what I got in my hand, because it feels a lot better in your hand while you're playing with it. And it's still pretty stiff to a lot of people, you know. What's this one here? This is a soft. Yes, sir. This is soft. Yes. And it's mostly used for heading. Beginners like to use the rope feet because they can handle it better. They can maneuver it better. The better you get, the more skilled you get, the harder the rope usually goes, because it'll stay open more. Like if you're in the competition,
speed means everything. Okay, what Scott's going to do now is just demonstrate some of the different roping techniques.
It really is, not everything else. Yeah. Well, you got what's called entropy. Like he was saying, my partner, or my nephew, I should say, he left this morning going to Troy, Alabama.
Should be on.
Should be on test, okay. He left this about 3 o'clock this afternoon going to Troy, Alabama, because he had already entered up. And the way they got it set up this day and age, if you enter it and don't show up, you're within association. They expect you to be there. If you don't show up, you get disqualified. You get penalized. You have a penalty tacked onto you, and it's probably 3/4 of your entry fee. So if your entry fee is $120, you got to pay $100 whether you show up or not. It's called turnout fees. So it's probably better for them to go to it than to get turned out on it. And plus, you at the end of the year, they got what's called a final, and you can win a saddle or belt buckles. Like I've won this one here in Gainesville, and we've also won saddles, and we got them over there on display that we've won. We've won money, and we've won as much as $5,000 in one day. We got another guy. He's been doing it for about 2 years, and He went out to Texas, him and another boy. Their fathers took him out there. He came home with a brand-new 97 double cab Ford Power Stroke that they gave away. Cost him $800 to enter it, but he won a brand-new truck. No, you know, he didn't have to pay for nothing. It has some decals on it. It's the worst thing he has to worry about. He's got to wear the decals for a year before he can take the decals off. I figured that's not a bad deal, $800 for a brand-new truck. We've won trailers. I got a little old white two-horse trailer over here that's got some riding on the back of it. It was about 8 or 9 years old, but I won that. So it's a lot of fun. We used to do it when we were in, we've done it since we was in high school. They even got junior rodeos now where the small kids get out there and they do it, and they junior rodeo. And they travel just like the big guys, and it's just like if you're a professional. They go every weekend. It wasn't nothing for us to go high school rodeo and have one rodeo, one steer in Miami, in Davie, Florida, rope it, get back in the truck and drive back to Tallahassee. 8 hours down there, an hour there, turn around, get in the truck and drive 8 hours home. And it didn't matter whether you caught or missed, you still had, that was the sport. That's what it's all about. It's nothing for us to leave on a Friday afternoon and drive to Davie, roping in Davie, Florida, which is Miami, get in a truck and drive all night, try to get to Nashville, Tennessee or something, rope there, come back into Atlanta Saturday night, roping Atlanta, be back in Miami Sunday morning, roping Sunday morning, and then be back in Kissimmee, roping Kissimmee, and then come home.
Are you hauling horses that whole time?
Yes, sir. A lot of people say, that you got to get out and let a horse walk about every 7 or 8 hours. And we do, but we also take our trailers. We got aluminum horse trailers, and they usually got about 2.5 foot of chips in them. And rubber mats in the bottom of them so that they can, they got a nice cushion ride. And we keep water to them. And, that's they're used to it. That's what they do for a living. And when they're not doing that, they turned out in the pasture so that they don't know any different. We never had one to get lame on us or nothing. Not from just hauling. But, yeah, they're right there with us, right there in that trailer. We pretty much keep one horse that is our rodeo horse that we go on full time. But at the practice pen, we may keep 3 or 4 saddled that we'll practice with, that we'll swap out because, we'll rope. We try to rope every night, practice every night. We'll practice Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, leave Friday night going to a rodeo. Get home Sunday night, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, practice every night. And like I say, we're not full time. We don't do it like the guys that are PRCA, Professional Rodeo Cowboy Association. They go full time. They travel all over the United States. They have one down in Kissimmee every year. At the same time, they got one out in Houston. And they'll be entered in Kissimmee tonight and be in Houston tomorrow night. And they'll travel from Houston. They'll have 2 performances back and forth. Yes, sir.
When you practice, you use this kind of model or just real cows?
No, so we use real cows. What this is just like where you practice to get your arm and everything correct as far as delivery and all. And then it's almost a whole nother ball game when you get up on a horse and do it, because you're using so many different muscles. Because you don't sit on the horse when you rope. You got to stand. You got the steering. You got the twirl. You got to keep him in position. You got the dally. It's a lot of practice into it, but it's also a lot of fun. It's a lot of responsibility as far as keeping a horse. You got to keep him fed. You got to keep him vet checked. You got to keep him doctored. you keep him, you know, it's warm medicine to him every 6 months, every 3 months. It's constantly something. And you got to really love it to do it because, I mean, how many people is going to want to ride to Miami for an hour and turn around and come home? You know, and that's how it is. Anything else? Yeah, the way people swing their ropes and all, back in the early 60s, late 50s, they used to be called the Turtle Association. Average time back then used to be 14, 15 seconds to catch a steer, where now you're looking in the 3 seconds. I mean, if you were 8 seconds at the NFR back then, you were doing something. I mean, you were one of the top, the elite. This day and age, if you ain't under 6 seconds, you ain't going to get no check. You might as well go home. But it's also got to do with, you know, the steers, the ropes. A lot's got to do with the style of horses that they breed now and the speed that they develop. And they would cross them up between thoroughbreds and quarter horses, so you got the cut, but you also got the speed out of them. The roping style's changed a lot. Leo Camarillo was one of the main ones who changed the revolution as far as how people deliver their ropes and twirl their ropes and going back then, where a lot of people used to swing the ropes and swing it to the side, a lot back then. There's a fella that's real good friends of mine. His name's Tommy Sala. He's been doing it all the time. He's 78 years old, still goes strong now, and he's still doing the rope sideways. You know, and he throws it. And 98% of the time, he's gonna kick the steer, but it may be 3/4 of the length down the river because it's hard to get a steer. Luck of the draw, they got what's called a barrier, which is like a head start. It's like a head start on the steer. What it is that they got a neck rope on the steer's neck. And then they got a rope packed there, and it's like an 8, 10, 15 foot. Out in Salina, California, it's 40 feet. What it is that it's got a rope across the chute where the cowboy and his horse sits at, and it's a rope there. And he can't cross that line until it drops. If he does, it's a 10-second penalty. And out in Salina, there's 40 foot strap there. That steer gets a 40 foot start before you can ever leave. And if he beats you to the back of the pen, you get a no time because he goes in the back shooting, he's out. So you got to have a horse that will fly on a 40 foot score. So speed is one thing, and being able to reach out there and catch him way out there and turn him, and the heeler can get there too. Is you know, all about speed. It really is. If you can't do it fast, sir. No, sir. I pretty much stay right here in the Big Bend area. I don't go Pensacola, about as far west I've ever been. Atlanta, Gainesville, up in that area. Birmingham, Alabama, and then I've been all the way down to Homestead in that area as far as South Florida. But we pretty much stay within that vicinity. It's the Southeastern Circuit is what it's called. And we pretty much stay right in that area as far as rodeo. A lot of the times I just go to them jackpots. I like going to a lot of jackpots and stuff. Jackpots is where they do nothing but just offer team roping. You go up there, you place your money, say, here's my money. I want to be the fastest person here. If I'm the fastest person, I get some of the pot that everybody puts in. And all they do is team rope. We've been to one that's been down in Newberry that started at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning and didn't end until 10 o'clock Sunday morning, nonstop. I mean, it'd be 7, 8, 9,000, 1,500 team ropers there. That's all they're doing is just roping steers. And you're there all night, and you're up all day. I mean, it's just a matter. You get there that morning, you may rope one at 9 o'clock in the morning. You might not rope again until 3 o'clock in the morning. What are you going to do during that time? Well, you can't really leave because you really ain't real sure when your time's going to come. That's where these dummies come in place. You go out there, and you get, you know, you sit around, and you talk, and you rope the dummy, and all you're doing, you're getting a better handle with your rope, and you're practicing, you're playing, and just you know, getting where, getting your fill of your rope and getting your confidence built up so when you get called back up again, you can go back in. A lot of that stuff is progressive. What I mean by progressive, you're going to rope five steers, okay? You're going to pay $50, you're going to rope five steers, but you got to catch your first one to go ahead to play with you, to get your second one. If you don't catch your second one, you don't get your third one, you see? So you got to catch your first one to get your next one. You got to catch your next one to get your next one. If you ever miss, you're out. You can pack up and go home. You're done. So you got to catch your steer to get your next steer. And then the last, your final round is usually fast time back. So whoever has the fastest time gets the rope first. And that's how that goes until they fill up all spots and nobody can beat them. So a lot of times that's what we go to. And that's what I was talking about with the truck ropings and stuff. It's called booger barter, which is where I won this belt buckle at, is a booger barter of roping. And he was getting big here in Florida. He did about 10 or 12 shows here, and then he went back to Texas, which is where he's from. And he still does them out there, and that's where that boy won that truck out there. He won a double cab truck on an $800 investment. Some of it's luck, but a lot of it's just – and some of it's physical and skill by hands, but I say 85% of it is psychological. You got to know that you can do it. You got to think positive that you know you can catch that steer and you can do it. Do some healing? Watching it on TV and you see team roping, you see Brent Buckus or Clay or Brian Cooper or some of them that are professionals at it, that do it, that are big time, that's how they make their living. If you'll watch their loop, that's what they practice. They also offer schools that guys can go to. I've been to some that's with Brent Buckus and them. And they'll help teach you how to rope and all, and they are a lot of help as far as, you know, they're professionals, and it's a lot of people just get out there and do it themselves and never teach themselves over and over again. And it's just like with any, you know, any professional football player. You see Joe Montana don't go out there and do it himself. He's one of the greatest, you know, quarterbacks there is, but you bet every year before the season starts, he gets out there and he got trained with these guys who don't know a thing. And it starts all over again. And it's the same thing with team roping, you know. You go right back to the basics. And as long as you stay with the basics and build yourself back up, you get better and better every year. If you work on the principles and the basics of it, and it just moves you along. Does anybody want to try?
How about a volunteer from the front row here? Y'all want to give it a try? Yeah, come. No? Yeah, come. Okay. We have a volunteer here. Okay.
Good try, good try. Any other volunteers? Ah, we got another one. Okay. You got it, you got it. Good job. Hey, good job. Excellent. So we got another volunteer. Not bad. All right. Any final questions for Scott or any final volunteers? A question and a volunteer. We'll take the volunteer first and then the question. You're the volunteer. Okay.
Hey, she's got good stuff. That was good.
So, Scott, what's the next rodeo you're going to?
Really, I ain't got none planned right now.
None planned right now?
Nah.
Okay.
I don't have anything planned. Probably the next one. Where we plan on going tomorrow night, I guess, over to Live Oak.
Okay.
There's one in Live Oak tomorrow night if y'all are from around here. There will be a performance over there. There will be a rodeo there. There will be team roping and all tomorrow night. So that'll we'll probably swing over there.
Swing over there. All right. Well, if you all want to see more of this type of roping, Scott will be located over at these tents to the far right, out in front of the tower. I believe he's going to be there all day Saturdays and a little of Sunday. Sunday too. So there'll be lots of other opportunities to try your hand at this and to learn a little bit more about rodeo arts. So, Scott, again, this is Scott Woodward. How about a round of applause? Thanks a lot for the demonstration. This is the last performance on this stage, so feel free to stick around and have some more tries at this.